The Big Picture, brought to you by Bible Society Australia, shining the light of God's Word into every corner of your world. And Sydney's Hope 103.2. There's always hope. The Big Picture, a Christian insight on the world of film, television and popular culture, with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley.
G'day, I'm Ben McKechin.
I love your Australian beginning. And I'm Mark Hadley. Welcome to The Big Picture for Monday, July 13. And coming up on today's show...
Ant-Man! Ant-Man, Marvel's smallest superheroes, now on the big screen, Mark.
Sorry. And the undead are alive in our backyard in new ABC TV series Glitch.
And for the first time ever in history, ever anywhere, Mark, we can reveal how to make the perfect comic book to movie adaptation. That's a true story.
Thank you very much.
Mark, how you doing?
I'm doing well.
I'm glad to hear it.
I'm glad.
Nice to see you.
Well,
thanks for joining us, everyone.
You might be wondering why we're actually doing this sort of slow-running intro, and that's because...
There's no reason. I was just checking out how you are. People like to know how you're going.
We should actually ask, shouldn't we?
Yeah, we should.
No, because we spend so much time planning every week that we just sort of get straight into business every week.
We do. And what we spent time planning this week was a whole bunch of things. As we just mentioned, Ant-Man's to come up. Glitch, this new TV show. We've got this soundtrack choices this week that it'll take a bit of explaining when we get there.
When we get there,
it'll be fantastic. And we've also got this interview coming up later in the show that's we tend to do on this show. We actually get experts on.
We're jam-packed. We've got two interviews.
We do. That's right. One of the later experts is... because we don't know what we're talking about. Let's be honest. We don't. Like, we try to. We pretend, but we...
I just like to point out that I actually do know what
I'm
talking about.
You do. Okay. We're getting someone on who's actually going to tell us a little bit about young adult fiction and moving to the big screen, because there's a film being released at cinemas this week that basically you and I don't know anything about and not qualified to speak about. That's Paper true. Towns is at cinemas this week.
So Cara Martin will be with us to talk about Paper Towns, and she's an expert in terms of book reviewing in Australia. We're really happy to have her on the show again.
But first, Mark, now we've got the pleasantries out of the way after I discovered that you're good and things are going well. What are we going to talk about first?
Well, look, first we're going to talk about superheroes. I mean, because honestly, aren't there enough? Isn't there a great lack? Isn't there a gap in the market somewhere for superhero films? Superheroes remain so big that even the smallest ones are being given their own shot at screen stardom. Ant-Man is yet another member of the massive Marvel cupboard that routinely is open to reveal better-known faces such as Iron Man, Captain America, or Hulk. But seriously, is the world really going to embrace an aspiring blockbuster about arguably the most unexpected hero ever, a professional thief turned microscopic crime fighter?
No, Ant-Man.
You know, I now see what you did there.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. And if it does, will there be something larger to embrace about how a baddie gets good in the Ant-Man origin story?
Imagine a soldier the size of an insect. The ultimate secret weapon.
If you give godlike powers to everyone, it's going to be chaos.
So how do we stop him?
By knowing I. Scott, I've been watching you for a while. You're different. And I believe everyone deserves a shot at redemption. Do you?
Ant-Man, Mark, yes, starts at cinemas this Thursday. Ant-Man, I just like saying Ant-Man because like out of the universe...
It was a bit of a stun. Of all the different characters you could pick, you know, from the Marvel Universe, Ant-Man was probably not high on my list.
Yeah, I think like, there's loads of comic book fans out there, but also plenty of people that don't know anything about the comic book origins of a lot of these superheroes, but they love the what Marvel has been able to do with their superheroes, as well as DC Comics, which is behind Batman and Superman, that kind of thing. So plenty of cinema fans are just embracing whatever superhero comes to the big screen. But Ant-Man, I'm still a bit baffled.
I know we're going to get letters from people who are actually huge Ant-Man.
Anyway, before we get a bit deeper into Ant-Man, I should just explain basically what Ant-Man is about. So on screens, it stars Paul Rudd, who is a bloke who is most best known for a lot of comedies.
Light comedy roles.
Like The 40-Year-Old Virgin and I Love You, Man, that kind of movie. he's a really unlikely superhero choice in a movie about a really unlikely superhero, about this, as you mentioned in the intro, this thief who gets this kind of opportunity for quote-unquote redemption that's offered to him by a character played by Michael Douglas, who's one of those rich billionaire, that's what billionaires are, they rich? These rich dudes who are scientists, but he's kind of eccentric and hidden away, and he's doing something...
Every scientist is eccentric in a Marvel aren't they?
And
film.
Also working on microscopic, or this nanotechnology, that somehow he recruits Paul Rudd's character to the thief to go on this one great mission to go and break in somewhere to get his technology back because it's going to fall into the wrong hands. And the wrong hands in this movie is played by a guy called Corey Stoll, who I think is now best known for his work on The House of Cards season one. He's the bad guy. Michael Douglas is back on big screen as kind of the mentor. But really, I don't really know what to expect from that man. Saying all of those kind of plot details,
Is it risky business for Marvel?
I mean,
because this sounds more like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Daredevil level, you know, TV series.
Those TV series spin-offs. Yeah, it is surprising that Ant-Man didn't go in that direction. Or even just get passed over, really. I mean, even the trailer itself, not in the clip that we played, but in other trailers, if you've seen them, they make a joke of even the name of Ant-Man to suggest, you know, like, oh, we couldn't think of something better, so we come up with Ant-Man. And we should mention that Ant-Man is what it says in the title, which is this guy who does shrink down to the size of an ant, has the powers of an ant, like as in superhero powers in relation to the size of ant and what he can
science of this is not quite clear.
No.
He's got the proportional size of an ant with the proportional size or strength of a human, if a human being had the ability of an ant. Like, it doesn't. Don't think about it. Maybe just go watch it.
Yes.
Look, how unlikely a hero is Ant-Man? I mean, is it the sort of, like, does it make sense even as a hero?
Yeah, kinda. I think, and again, here's where the letters will come to us from massive fans of Ant-Man. And I don't know the back history of the Ant-Man comic series. And I think, though, to get back to your first question on is this risky business for Marvel? Yes, even though people, like last week's show, we talked a lot about franchises and how people go, myself included, just trot out to all kinds of series and sequels all the time now, particularly superhero ones. And if anything's got Marvel written on it now, people will tend to show up to see it. So I think Ant-Man's going to go right on that front. But otherwise, it may tank because... like just the whole concept of the small pint-sized warrior might not get up, but the unlikeliness of throwing a thief, so a guy who's made a professional career out of being not very good, being put into this position of being the hero, out of all the superheroes you can think of, he is one of the most unlikely guys to ever show up. I think to be the guy at the front who you're meant to be cheering on and barracking for and wanting to be, yeah, I think putting a thief in that spot raises some interesting questions.
From a Christian perspective, one of the questions that rises in my head is just the philosophy that seems to sit behind this, that here's a bad guy, and we've seen these sort of turn over a new leaf type stories again, my life has become so bad, I'm going to start being good. But can you really do enough good to somehow set aside bad? I mean, like, that's how many people see the universe. Here's Ant-Man, he's done bad things in his past. If he does good things now, then the balance or the weighing up of all these things, if he's enough good in the ledger, he's ultimately a good guy. Is that how it works?
That seems to be what Ant-Man's going to deliver. And along the way, it'll deliver, I'm sure, massive special effects. But it might even involve, like, Ant-Man fighting ants, maybe, or flies or something like that.
No, he gets to control bugs in this one.
Oh, he's the master of bugs.
He's the master of bugs, master.
Yeah, looking forward to that. I'm very curious about seeing Ant-Man and what it's like. Yeah, I'd imagine that they will present this sort of two sides of a scale idea where it's usually, people reflect on the bad they've done and they think they can make up for it with good.
Which is a common view in a society.
This is how
I'm going to recommend myself to God in the end.
Yeah, like
I was bad, but if I do enough good.
Or even if you don't believe in God, but you just think somehow that the bad you've done in life is like, it's like kind of like eroded, taken away from one side of an account and you can kind of top up on the other side by doing good. But I think whether you believe in God or you don't, if you think that line of thought through, who's to determine how that actually works? So what exactly are you doing? So the bad that you've done, it could have been everything from lying to someone to murdering someone. How do you make up for that? How does a good deed make up? So if you tell the truth, does it make up for a lie? If you, resurrect someone, that makes up for a murder? You know what I mean? Like, how could you actually justify your action? How can you go on the path to redemption that a lot of these superhero movies and plenty of movies seem to present as this, like, well, if as long as I do enough good, I'll be able to make up for the bad. How does that actually work as a system in the universe that we exist in? I'd question that. Whereas on the Christian front, thank God that the centerpiece of Christianity, Jesus, is what he's holding out to people is saying, I know that you've done bad things. You've done good things, but I know you've done bad things. You can never make up for that yourself. Like, you just there is no possible way you can do that, because how can you do it? How can you do it? But what Jesus is offering, to my mind at least, is the most credible solution for this issue that redemption is a big word, but that's the issue that we're looking at, and so many movies try to address it, this idea of someone trying to make up for the bad they've done in their life. But if you haven't investigated what Jesus is offering on this front in terms of how you would quote-unquote make up for the bad you've done in your life, highly recommend doing that, because in contrast to what films like Ant-Man and many others present, what he's holding out, to me at least, holds water. So it'd be interesting going into Ant-Man and seeing how they present that side of things. That's one of the many things I'm curious and interested in Ant-Man. The jury's still out for me about how successful it's going to be, but I think if anything gets it over the line, it'll be the fact that it's a Marvel superhero and a franchise in the making.
Well, Ant-Man is released nationally from Thursday, July 16. Starring Paul Rudd and Michael Douglas, Ant-Man had not been rated at the time that we're saying this, but it's likely to be filled in with cartoonish violence. So generally speaking, that earns it about an M.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what they'll be pitching for. Mate, what have we got coming up next? Oh, that's right. We're going to be talking about this new TV show, this ABC show, Glitch, which I don't really like the title. Like, do you?
Well, it's interesting because the title says something about the philosophy of the program. We'll talk about that, you know, a little later. But Glitch is basically an opportunity to look into what we think as Australians about life, death, and what comes after death.
Would this make any sense?
Don't tell any of the others about this.
What, are you asking me to lie?
I need to know that I can trust you. I don't belong here.
When I came back, they'd gone.
Stay inside, lock the doors. Are you okay?
We can't protect these people.
This isn't a miracle. It's a punishment.
There is no justice. Nothing is fair. You just live your life.
Mate, so that sounds like a big budget Hollywood trailer for some movie, but I haven't watched this yet. But what you're telling me, this is like Australia's version of the TV series The Walking Dead, and yet it's more mystery than horror and mayhem. Is that right?
Yeah. Now, I think a lot of people would be saying, if we said the Australia's version of The Walking Dead, there's enough cultural cringe for us to go, oh no, what might go wrong with that? But the truth is, this is actually, and hear me clearly, a really good show. This is an example of an Australian series that I think is going to work remarkably well. And the reason why is because Glitch is not overreaching itself. So basically, the storyline for Glitch is that there's a small fictional town called Urana, which is in country Victoria. It's a two-cop town. You know, it's a very familiar sort of thing with the police station, kind of like, you know, a country practice sort of setting. And
that show back in the 80s, that was so long-running, they're just about small town life in country. That was country Victoria.
That was country,
wasn't it?
New South Wales.
Country New South Wales.
Well, you know, the country looks remarkably similar.
But now we've moved to Victoria. It's like 30 years on. What's happening in country Victoria?
Well, people are emerging from the cemetery at night.
Sure.
Okay.
Yep.
And this is, and they don't, it sounds.
Oh, this is the Waking Dead thing. So for anyone who hasn't seen the American TV show Waking Dead, is basically about people Walking Dead is people trying to survive after an apocalypse where zombies are running riot across America. That's what Walking Dead is about.
Yeah, but this is not that. So what basically happens, you've got a small town where people are emerging in the middle of the night from the cemetery covered in mud and quite distressed because they suddenly found themselves alive. Not that they have any recollection of what happened before, but just that if you pull yourself out of a grave, I'm sure you suddenly feel somewhat, you know, out of place too. But that's it. And of course, the small town that have discovered these people are a little perturbed too, because people who have been, not just, it's like, you know, their mother-in-law or their girlfriend, or in one particular case, the most poignant, the wife of someone who has died, have come back. But people who've been dead for 100 years have been dead. And so now there's culture shock involved as well. What would it be like if somebody who died in the, you know, 1820s is suddenly on your doorstep?
That sounds like a great idea for a show. How does it rate in the scheme of Australian productions? Because it sounds like that's the really big ideas for a TV show.
It is very, very good. Now, I've got to say, for a start, it's like There's a film that came out a couple of years ago called Safety Not Guaranteed that was actually about sort of time travel. And it was fantastic because it wasn't actually built on special effects, but on the script and the story and the ideas and how, and really good acting. And that's exactly what could be said for Glitch. That it's not about the special effects, though there are a few special effects that are kind of pretty well done, but they're used conservatively and well. And then you've got a sort of a moment, but really it's about what would you do if somebody who had died walks back into your life? And it's clear that they're dead. You know, and so what are you going to do? How would you react to a personal encounter with a resurrection?
And do you think this TV series actually presents a pretty good, it's a good representation of what someone would do if they were confronted by people coming back from the dead?
I think it is.
This is like, it's a pretty outlandish idea.
There's one little jump the tracks moment, but look, to be honest, most people are somewhat shocked. There's a really touching...
they should be.
There's a really touching... Well, you see, there's the whole gamut of disbelief. Firstly, they want to say, like, you are not really the person. Secondly, they want to say, okay, you are the person, but you weren't really dead. And then thirdly, they want to say, okay, you are the person, and you were really dead, but I have no idea how you got here, and I'm not sure what I'm going to do. There's fear that people will lose the person who's just come back. You don't, weirdly, all of this gamut of response to somebody who returns from dead is actually covered in the New Testament. Now, weirdly, all of it's almost as if they read the Gospels and went, look at all the way that people responded to Jesus when he returned.
Let's put that in Country Victoria as a zombie TV show. So
now, the only moment I think there's a little tense, you'll see this in episode one, is when they decide to keep this to themselves. Okay, and the reason why they keep it to themselves is because they're afraid it's all going to end, or they'll miss the opportunity, and or these people,
the people in the town, you mean?
Yeah, the people that who've returned will be taken away. So there's various characters who decide we can keep it to themselves.
Is that believable?
No, that's the one thing I don't find believable. I don't want to spoil it. There's a plot device they introduce which makes it clear they better keep it to themselves. But that said, the explosive truthfulness of the resurrection, as far as Jesus was concerned, is that you just can't keep something like this to yourself. It is clearly going to start reverberating out. And of course, the effect, the effect today of Jesus' resurrection is quite clear, with it being, you know, the most accredited religion, you know, in the world.
So. And so, speaking of all this rising from the dead and zombies and, TV.
Zombies,
and...
not zombies, but fully resurrected people. Yeah.
Right, so they don't get called zombies?
They're not.
How could you resist calling these people zombies?
Well, because
they're not trying to eat your brains.
And they're not going,
Yeah, okay,
they're quite eloquent at points.
Right, so dealing with that category of people, how does Glitch then represent the afterlife? Like, is that an actual concept that's... Are these kind of ideas raised
in
the show?
It's really telling. It's really telling because the way they represent the afterlife is very much how most Australians see the afterlife. Now, I'm not just making a generalisation here. The most Australians, according to AC Nielsen, a poll 2 years ago, actually believe in the afterlife, but only 56% of them would say that there's such a place as heaven. So they believe in an existence, something happens, but they're not quite sure. And that's what Glitch presents. The dead return with no idea of what has happened, with no different questions to the people who are alive. Why am I here? What's going on? Should I, you know, is this a limited time? Should I be making the most of this? Should I be thinking about God because this return to life is so spectacular? Should I just be living and loving now? And the Australian view of the afterlife is one of big question marks and confusion, and focusing very much on the now. So the dead return and people ask them, you know, what happened? And they go,
hey, where you been?
I don't know. I was gone. Now I'm back. I can't really remember it. You know, there you go.
So it sounds like it probably stirs up more questions than it provides answers.
It does, but the focus comes down, you know, very much in terms of Australian life onto, well, you're loved and you better love now. That's the best you can do. So, you know, you're returned, great. Let's just concentrate on loving each other and loving you now as you're here. So it's a remarkably unhelpful view of the afterlife because, weirdly, it's talking about resurrection, and the one documented occasion of real resurrection actually came back with a huge amount of information about what's coming next and what we have to do now, and Glitch is not going to give you any of those.
But it's still quite a highly recommended show.
Oh, look, I think it's going to be... It's great watching TV, so it's brilliant to watch. It's also well worth looking into and seeing what it... People are going to be talking about what happens when you die in relationship to this television program. As a Christian, why wouldn't you watch that? Why wouldn't you be part of that?
So you can witness your own Rise of the Living Dead on the ABC from Thursday. So it starts this Thursday from 9:35 p.m.
Yep. Actually, no. Episode one was last Thursday. Okay, but it's still, there's a rerun of it this week too, and there's also iView. But it now goes on from this Thursday. Honestly, it's very, very easy to catch up with. You should see it.
It stars Patrick Bramall, Genevieve O'Reilly, Emma Booth, and is rated M for mature themes and language. Now, I was trying to think of a fitting segue talking about the undead and rising from the dead. I couldn't really, so I'm just going to go into a plug for one of the sponsors of our show, Insights Magazine. What I can say is they're alive with commentary on movie making. That's what the Insights website is. See what they did?
Well done resurrecting that link.
Yeah, good one. It's one of the few Christian sites in Australia that every single week brings you detailed perspectives on cinema releases. So go to the Insights website and check out all their full-blooded... I'm going to stop now.
Yeah, I think now would be a good time to move on to soundtrack. Soundtrack this week. Now, we just want to give you an insight into how the big picture works. You might think that we just get together each week and throw a bunch of things, cobble them together, loosely drape a theme over it, and call that a program.
That's what I think we do.
Well, you're right. That's pretty much what we do.
That was the impression I had.
But we actually meet several times during the week. We have production meetings.
If you can believe it.
I know, it's amazing. We actually come up with this. But we have production meetings, scripting meetings, and all sorts of things to come up with this moment. And sometimes things change. They change really, really quickly.
They really do.
Like when Glitch was actually sort of popped onto the ABC schedule, we went, right, okay, instead of doing Aquarius, which is a retrospective show that we're going to look back about, David Duchovny becoming a detective, encountering the Mansons, and, you know,
back in the Charles 70s? Manson, yeah, it's a new American TV show.
Basically look back retrospective show, we would actually do Glitch because that's far more important. You guys should be more aware of that.
Which then impacted the next segment of our show.
But what we were going to do is a whole bunch of other things about looking back and being retrospective. So here's the half-hearted rest of the show. The soundtrack this week begins with this classic track from a classic British show. If you don't know what I'm talking about, it's pretty easy to pick up what show. It's Heartbeat. Okay, Heartbeat was a British show back in... Well, I was going to say back in the 80s, but the weird thing is Heartbeat ran for 18 years. You know, I was stunned.
How many? Like 18 looked, series?
300... No, 18 years, 372 episodes, and was one of the most successful television series ever to be on British television. 10 million viewers every episode plus, okay?
So jeez Louise.
It was all of our parents and our grandparents, because basically it's a series that's set in the 1960s. We picked Heartbeat as we were thinking about retrospective music, you know, programs that bring life back into sort of old tracks. Heartbeat actually took a rockabilly song originally recorded by Buddy Holly in 1958, that was actually a B-side track that never got any higher than 82 in the charts. And when it came out as part of the television series, Nick Berry, who's one of the stars in it, recorded it and it reached number 2.
Good on you, Nick.
There you go. And then also multiple Heartbeat albums came out after that, because Heartbeat was, if you remember, is one of those classic shows actually building in lots of 60s songs all the way through the show.
So it was a weekly jukebox.
So we figured that was a fantastic sort of example of that retrospective show making good with retrospective music for soundtrack this week.
Speaking of retrospectives, Mark, and as you just explained to listeners about how well organized we are as a show, how well oiled, and but also how late breaking changes can happen
on
the big picture.
We will change on a dime.
Yeah, we will. Apart from we won't, because given this retrospective theme that we had, we talked to Bible Society Australia's CEO and social commentator Greg Clark, who, as regular listeners of the program would know, Greg speaks to us every week about what the Bible has to say on a particular topic. Well, we were thinking about retrospective, so we asked him to share some of his thoughts on what the Bible has to say about looking back.
In the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways, but in these last days, he's spoken to us by his Son, says Hebrews chapter 1 in the Bible. If you've never picked up a Bible, it's probably nothing like you imagine it to be. In my experience, most people who haven't yet opened its pages or clicked on the app and scrolled the screen as we do now are in for a big surprise. I well remember a lovely middle-aged woman coming up to me after a sermon I gave once on the Book of Romans, and after she told me that she'd come to church because she'd never read the Bible, loudly proclaiming to me that my sermon had been so offensive. "That wasn't the St. Paul I know," she complained. I still don't know how she was so sure. But she's not alone. Most people have a view of what is in the Bible, even if they don't know that it has two testaments. What I'm keen on is pointing out the things that are obvious to those who've read it, but surprising to those who haven't. Let me give you a few. To start with, the Bible is not a book. It's a collection of books, a library, a specially arranged compendium that makes sense from start to finish, like a well-curated museum exhibit. It starts with the beginning of all things, and it ends with the future of all things. It's a pretty comprehensive book. Next, the Bible is history. It's looking back on what has gone before and making sense of it. In fact, what Christians call the New Testament, the second part of the Bible, is the essential guide to making sense of the first part, or the Hebrew Bible, or the Old Testament. And finally, the Bible also looks forward, all the way forward into what the future is going to be like. It actually reduces our level of surprise about the future by explaining to us that Jesus Christ not only makes sense of looking back on the past, but also shows us what the future will be like. For those who haven't read it, the hint is that if you read the New Testament to find out what Jesus is like, you're well on your way to knowing what the future is all about. A book about the past that also explains the future. That's worth your attention right here in the present.
Greg Clark there, Mark, helping us to understand that Christianity and God's word can help us to look back so we can see what's coming up. I think as we look back over this show, we'll reflect on, when we make late-breaking changes, maybe we should make some late-breaking changes to all the segments and not just...
I blame the producer because it's safe to do so.
It was so nicely themed around retrospective and looking back until we made that change with the glitch, which was looking back to earlier in the show, but now to the future of this program, Mark. Take us there.
I will. Actually, earlier we mentioned one of the sponsors of the show, in fact, one of the great resources out there for Christians who are considering culture, and that was Insights. Another one is actually Eternity Magazine. Eternity newspaper, and Eternity has an online site, again, worth looking at. The July edition's out in churches at the moment. There's an article I think you really should have a look at called Renewing Hope in Iraq. It's a year from the horrible, it's basically a year from the horrible ultimatum given to Christians in the northern town of Mosul in Iraq. They basically had three options: convert to Islam, pay a protection tax, and or leave. And if you don't, die. Okay, Christians have been fleeing that city since it was taken over by Islamic State the month before, but the ultimatum flung the plight of Iraq's Christians onto the world stage. Now, a year later, Bible Society in Iraq reports back on how they've been supporting Christian refugees and their prayer that many will choose to stay to be salt and light in the Middle East. That's it, to stay in a situation in which their lives and the families' lives will be under threat. And I actually think, it's a very, very challenging article for comfortable Christianity in Australia, and to know what our brothers and sisters are doing overseas. Thoroughly recommend Renewing Hope in Iraq. You can find it online at the Eternity website, or go check out a copy of the July edition of Eternity.
Right. So that's what's coming up in Eternity in the future. What about the future of this program, Mark? But in the immediate future, what's next?
Well, right now we're going on to press record. On the big picture, Ben and I don't mind admitting that there are big questions we just don't know the answer to.
So that does happen occasionally.
So we think, why not actually admit that publicly, which we just did, and then try to find some people to answer those questions for us. This week's big question wasn't who can possibly explain why Police Academy made it to 7 movies, but Lemony Snicket only scored 1, which is in itself a question that should be answered.
I don't have
the
answer to that.
But how is it that the Terminator movies still haven't worked out to send back an army of serial killers one at a time? But according, if they don't,
why don't they just send an army of robots back and just invade? Why doesn't that happen?
No, these are not the big questions.
Oh, that's not the question we're answering. No,
the big question we wanted to solve for this week was, how do you make the perfect comic book movie?
That's an awesome question.
It is, and there should be a recipe by now. basically since it's being done over and over again. With Ant-Man hoping to make it big at the cinemas, we wondered whether anyone knows the precise recipe for guaranteeing that a movie version of a comic or graphic novel will be a success. And we're not talking about half-hearted attempts. It will knock it out of the park. This week, as you'll hear in our good old press record segment, Ben spoke with James Snare, a fourth-year theology student in Sydney and a lifelong comic devotee and movie nerd. Because if anyone has the answers, we thinky inky James surely does.
Thinky and inky James.
I know.
Thinky and inky.
This is a lesson as to why you shouldn't let somebody else write your intro.
Press record. James, so I understand you've had a lifelong interest, a passion for comic books and graphic novels. Tell us first, where did this all begin for you and why has it been so enduring?
Well, it all started with The Amazing Spider-Man, number 425. That was my first ever purchase, and I've been reading for about 18 years or so since then. And as for the fascination, I guess it first started because I saw these iconic images of heroes that were powerful and transcendent, everything that I aspired to be as an insecure teenager. So I really started reading them as a means of escape and a desire to be as cool and together as the heroes that I saw on the page.
And did that happen?
Over the years, no, unfortunately not. I'm still, in my own mind it did, but people tell me I didn't succeed. But I guess over the years I've stuck with them because the really good comic stories are either mythic tales that can lift your heart and inspire you to have hope and be courageous, or they take you down into the gutter and show you the grittiness of the world, which is kind of cathartic in a different sort of way. So there's like a hyper-realism to a good comic where reality and fiction blend in a way that just heightens the intensity of what we see every day so we actually sit up and take notice of it. It's pretty cool.
Now, before we get to the big question, I really want to ask you, James, I want to quickly clarify something. For those of us playing at home that don't know the difference between what a comic book is and what a graphic novel is, can you explain the difference?
Yeah, so typically a comic book is a single issue of a particular story or character that comes out monthly. And so it's normally about 32 pages long, but a graphic novel is a much longer form. So it's literally what it says. It's a novel that's told in comic strip format. So it's just a lot of pictures telling a story with the words and everything thrown in, but it's a much bigger story typically.
Right. Now let's move on to this big question, James. And this question for you is, given you're a guy who's got 18 years experience, so you should know the answer to this. If you were going to tell me how to make the best guaranteed surefire hit adaptation of a comic book or graphic novel, turn it into a movie, how would I go about doing that? What are the elements that I need?
Well, I think obviously the obvious things, like it's got to look fantastic and not lame or cheesy, but I think most studios...
So do I need a lot of money?
Spider-Man. Yeah, I think you do. I think you need a lot of cash. I think you need a lot of technology. You need to look cool and all that sort of thing. But I think the main thing, the number one thing that you've got to nail is the spirit of the character that you're working with.
Can you give us some examples of ones where you think they've really nailed it?
Yeah, absolutely. So take the X-Men films. They have ebbed and flowed in quality overall, but the fact that they've really nailed, characters like Magneto and Professor X and the relationship between the two of them has sort of been this anchor point that has allowed comic fans to sort of buy in and still say, that's pretty cool. So I think Marvel Studios have done a great job with this. I trust that when I go along and see one of their films, the Captain America they're putting on screen is the Captain America that I read in the comic books. Even if they've messed around with chronology or pacing and plot and all that sort of thing, if they nail the spirit of the character, then they've got me and I'm in.
And then to put an even more precise point on it, is this come down to casting particularly about trying to capture the essence of a character? And do you think especially the Marvel Universe has been able to do this on screen?
I think so, and they've done a really good job. So when I first heard that, the Black Widow was going to be played by Scarlett Johansson, I was devastated. I was like, that's not going to work. They're insane.
Were you one of those guys on forums and were you digitally picketing and sending out rally cries to people to get Scarlett banned from the movie?
For the sake of my own reputation, I don't actually comment, but I read them all and just, agree very fervently in my heart. But you know what? She's done an awesome job with it. And Black Widow is one of my favorite female characters in the Marvel Universe. And, I don't like the whole Black Widow-Hulk romance in Age of Ultron. That wasn't really cool. But, apart from that, it's been awesome to see it up there. I think casting is really big, but it's more how they write the character. Like, if you're not going to respect the source material, don't make a comic book movie. Make your own stuff up. That's more important.
Mate, thank you very much. Now we're going to run away after having taken notes and try to make our own comic book movie after knowing it's all about the money, the look, the essence, and the story that we've got. That all makes sense to me. Now before you leave us, you're a fourth-year theology student, but as you by your own admission, you're a massive fan of comics and of movies. Can you explain for me just very quickly how all those things sort of come together?
The thing about comics in general, and particularly, you know, books with superheroes and that sort of stuff, there's these themes that they just constantly return to, like power, redemption, sacrifice, rebirth, true heroism, and these are all things that I think touch on the heart of Christianity. So I think comic books are really, really good at diagnosing the problems in the world, and you know, they don't always nail the answer, which is the gospel and everything that Christ has done for us through his work on the cross. But I think that the fact that those things are always in there reminds me that these issues are universal, and that the gospel is relevant to our world, even if they reject it, even if they tell us it's not. The fact that our culture is so interested in just the explosion of interest in superheroes and sort of themes that come along with that show us that there's a bridge for Christians to really speak the gospel into people's lives because they're so interested in these themes. And that encourages me and inspires me to keep meditating on Christ and what he's done so that I can speak to culture and what they're interested in. So I think that's really important for a Christian to recognize.
Mate, you should be terribly enlightened after that. Terribly is the wrong adjective to use but you know what I'm saying.
I'm embarrassed that I laughed earlier at that segment. That was a brilliant segment. Thanks very much to
and
James.
And I'm about to race off and write my own perfect adaptation of a comic book. No, well, not really. Actually, I'm too lazy to do that.
I want to adapt a book into a comic book film. I think Pride and Prejudice as a comic book film.
You know that Pride and Prejudice and Zombies is coming, don't you?
Yes, I know. I've read the book and I'm ready.
Yeah. That is a comic book, isn't it?
It's not a comic book. No, it's
a... No, it's a true it's an literary
novel.
Work.
It's an actual novel. Yeah.
While we're on the subject of comic books, that leads us into the next segment of the show, the regular top five, where we look across the movie universe and think, what can we narrow it down to? Because of the talking about comic books, we thought... We actually had a number of suggestions about which way we could try to tackle this, you know, best comic book adaptations. But then James just smashed it in that interview.
He's told us everything we need to know. So why do it again?
So instead, the top five this week is going to be comic book movie adaptations that you didn't realize were based on comic books.
Okay.
So at number five?
Five.
2006 DreamWorks animated film Over the Hedge.
Was a comic book. Unbelievable.
Yeah, you know, this movie, it was kind of about like a squirrel and a raccoon and a turtle that had the voices, of course, of Bruce Willis and Steve Carell. William Shatner turned up.
Who can forget?
The
Shatner.
But this was originally a comic strip that was around from 1995. And for anyone who saw the movie, it sort of, in the DreamWorks animated scheme of things, didn't go as well, wasn't as prominent as like, you know, Shrek or How to Train Your Dragon.
But strangely watchable.
And it was, that's what I was going to say, I think it's a little bit underrated. And what I found out about the comic strip originally is that it went a bit harder on its message of humanity and technology and consumerism and suburbia in terms of like throwing them in the melting pot and chucking them up as satire in this animated animal,
as seen through
illustrated
the eyes of animals,
animal
yeah.
way. Yeah, and so the comic strip had that, and I think the movie version did do a pretty good job. From what I understand, the comic originally did. I think the movie version did quite well. Underrated film. If you haven't seen it, go and check it out. It's really quite good. Over the Hedge, that's number five.
Four.
On this list, Mark, I like to try to pick some kind of curveball, some sort of like... And even on a list where of comic book movies you didn't know were a comic book, I'm just going to pick a movie that you probably haven't even seen, so you wouldn't have even thought that it was based on comic book because you didn't know it existed.
Okay.
This 2010 biopic called Gainsborough. It's French movie, Gainsborough. It's about... I've done it again. The French movies are back.
I wondered if we could actually get 3 weeks without a French movie reference. For those people who are playing the non-alcoholic, big picture sanctioned drinking game, you may now take a sip.
You just won because Ben somehow shoehorned a non-English speaking film into this list. At this number four choice, I was going to pick The Mask, that much more well-known film.
But why?
Jim Carrey, Cameron Diaz. That's right. But Gainsborough has a very similar idea, but in a much different, presented in a much different way. So Gainsborough is a biopic about a 60s, 70s, very famous pop singer and artist from France, Serge Gainsborough. And unlike most other biopics, it's not based on an autobiography or a biography. It's based on a graphic novel about the life of Serge Gainsborough. And one of the representations of Serge Gainsborough in the movie is this character called the Mug, which is basically this kind of grotesque life-size version of Serge Gainsborough, but the sort of the things that he loathes about himself, particularly his own appearance. And this character in the movie is this kind of life-size, really ugly figure who's played by an actor called Doug Jones, who's probably most well known.
Can everybody see him, or is he just
only Serge Gainsborough in the movie.
Got him,
but he's played by an actor called Doug Jones, who I think is probably best known for his work with a director called Guillermo del Toro, who made Hellboy and Pacific Rim, but also made Pan's Labyrinth. And there's some amazing characters in Pan's Labyrinth. If anyone's seen that movie,
you really should see it.
You will remember this the character with the eyes and the hands.
Yeah.
That was played by Doug Jones, who also plays this figure of Serge Gainsborough, who effectively is like this grotesque version, even more grotesque version of the Mask. So that's why I picked Gainsborough at number 4. 3. But now we're back into much better known territory. Although it probably isn't that well known, which is why it's on this list, that Men in Black, the 1997 film with Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones that erupted into quite the spectacular franchise that wasn't as great in the sequels, but the first one still is very, very good, was a comic book.
Now, I knew that, but actually I'm kidding.
No, you meant to say no, you didn't know that.
Oh, well, let me try again. Oh, you're kidding.
No, I'm not, Mark. Men in Black.
I hate it when you kid me.
That comic book started in the 1990s, and it was on some smaller label, but eventually it made its way to Marvel, I think because Marvel bought out the smaller label. In Marvel's massive...
acquisition of titles.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's quest for global domination. It took in Men in Black as well. Apparently, in the original comic series, the brief was bigger in terms of what the Men in Black were actually there to do. So it wasn't just aliens that they were going up against. They were pretty much taking down anything that was paranormal. So they were going after werewolves, zombies, demons, all of it.
Well, that's the franchise. And if you like the idea of franchises, you should check out our last episode where we discuss it ad nauseum. But, I mean, I like that idea that Men in Black are basically saying to themselves, you know, all this equipment's just sitting around. 60% of the time we're striking out with aliens, but there's an accountant here who's saying, you know, we can get this equipment working on paranormal things. We could take care of those poltergeists for that people too and earn an extra buck for the company.
So that's number 3. 2. This great 2002 hard-boiled noirish drama that's actually set back in the 1930s called Road to Perdition.
Road to Perdition was a graphic novel.
For anyone who doesn't know, James helpfully explained that to us earlier, what the difference between a comic and a graphic novel is. This was based on a graphic novel that was in one of the kind of subsections of the famous DC Comics label. Tom Hanks stars in the movie version as this 1930s henchman for a mobster played by Paul Newman, and as you know, as tends to happen, he gets stitched up and he goes on the road to revenge. But one of the more fascinating things about that movie is the father-son relationship that happens at the core of it. But for a movie that you didn't really know was based on a comic that came out in the 90s, I think it was, that's actually based, itself is based on a 1970s Japanese manga series called Lone Wolf and Cub. So I picked a movie that's not just based on one comic book, but based on another. Thank you very much.
You've won on one-on-one. I've got another example of that, but I won't give it away just in case it's your number one.
What is my number one? 1. What is my number one? Glad you asked. 2005's A History of Violence.
That was a graphic novel?
That was a graphic novel.
See how I stopped myself saying comic there, because I've learned now? First, James.
And I think this is a movie that I imagine a lot of big picture listeners haven't seen. Again, here's the word of warning to those listening. I'm not advocating you rush out to see this movie. As the title would suggest, A History of Violence, there are some very graphic, disturbing images in this movie. But for me, this is one of the most tightly wound economic crime thrillers that's ever existed. Directed by a fantastic Canadian director called David Cronenberg. It stars Viggo Mortensen, who's most popularly known for his work in the Lord of the Rings series. It's about a guy who lives in a small town and he runs a diner. And then one day these thugs turn up, and what comes from all of that is basically that he may or may not have a hidden past that involves mobs and gangsters and that kind of thing. One of the great things about this adaptation from a comic book is the original author, or one of the co-writers of the book, Josh Olson, worked on the screenplay. They changed a number of things from the original comic to get it to screen, particularly where the original comic was all flashbacks, and then they added a character in the end who's really quite like powerful that William Hurt plays on screen. But the most memorable thing, I think, about History of Violence, and if anyone's listening out there who presents talks at churches and they like to use film clips from movies, you'd want to use this sparingly from A History of Violence. But what that movie is about and what it represents very strongly is a man who's tried to run from his past, and it's this graphic demonstration that you cannot do that. As in, you cannot change yourself, you can't reinvent yourself and pretend like it didn't happen. You can't get away from things, and sometimes your past will come back and hunt you down, as what happens in A History of Violence. And for me as a Christian, thinking about that and thinking about how your life can change so significantly when the Holy Spirit comes into it and kind of revolutionizes who you are still who you are. It doesn't paper over your past. You don't become this sort of different person, but you become a new person, but not in the way that A History of Violence presents. And it goes so spectacularly wrong in History of Violence. That's why I find it so memorable and powerful.
So the practical upshot, just for a second, I take it then that, you know, if you can't run from your past, what is the option?
Well, History of Violence would say you just keep running and grab a gun.
And what does Christianity say instead?
Christianity says we'll deal with it with Jesus, everything from the forgiveness that's found in Him to the way that inviting Jesus into your life will assist you in making changes where you will not just you'll still make mistakes and errors, but you will want to repeat the mistakes and errors of your past less because you want to become the better, more improved person you can be in the image, in the identity of Jesus, in the modeling, emulating of who that guy is. You will want to change the ways you were previously and you'll want to work on them. History of Violence doesn't demonstrate that, but it's a powerful film, and that's why it came in at number one as the movie that you didn't realize was based on a comic book.
You're the big hero.
Really don't like talking about it, sir.
You sure took care of those two bad men, Joey.
My name is Tom. Joey,
you tell me.
Sarah? Sarah! My daughter, where is she?
What's going on, Dad?
They thought they knew me. Thought I was somebody else.
Nothing to worry about, Mrs. Stahl. I've been watching over.
I don't know what you want, and I don't really care.
You should care about what I want, because what I want might change your life.
And that is A History of Violence. Well worth a look. Again, a few cautions from us. Basically,
yeah,
to say
yeah,
be careful
very strong violence and some sex scenes in it, but wow.
Really worth.
Oof,
history, okay, oof. Moving us on to a second part of soundtrack. Let's play this track and I'll tell you why you're listening to it. Blue Velvet is sung by Bobby Vinton, and it appears in another fantastic series for being retrospective in its use of music and really working hard to use music to set up the characters. And, of course, I'm talking about Mad Men.
Oh, Mad Men, such
a
great
series. If you haven't discovered that yet and you're saying to yourself, what will I now watch after Glitch? Well, then you take out a DVD and you put in Mad Men.
Or check it out on Netflix.
Or Netflix, too. Who does not sponsor this show?
But they can if they like.
We do appreciate it. But look, it was this particular song, though, Blue Velvet, was written in 1950 by Bernie Wayne, but it was really made famous in 1963 by Bobby Vinton, the guy who's actually singing this version now, when it went to number one on the Billboard Hot 100. Rolling Stone magazine, though, called it kind of like a doleful prom anthem, and I think that's actually why Mad Men picked it up, because there's this key character called Betty, who's actually sort of one of the key wives in the series, and she is the ultimate prom queen who married the wonderful guy and is now trying to find out what her life means afterwards.
Apparently wonderful guy.
And so Blue Velvet is something of her theme in the series, and that's what Mad Men does. It basically mines its period, it's set in the 60s, for songs that really represent the characters. I think well worth a think about the next time you're watching a television program.
Precious and warm on me. The years, and they still can see blue velvet through.
Mark, it's that time of the show again where we talk about what your kids are watching. And what they'll definitely be watching this week is a new release at cinemas, Paper Towns. Now, when you and I first saw the trailer for Paper Towns, we chortled out loud.
We did. We sniggered.
Yeah, we did.
There's no getting away from it. We weren't actually that respectful.
No, and we realized, I don't think this movie is for us. And we're probably not the best people to be talking about this movie, which is the latest romantic drama. It's based upon a mega-selling novel by the author of the mega-selling novel, The Fault in Our Stars. And that's a guy called John Green. Now, if you're a parent out there who, gets a bit worried about what their kids are watching, and also a little bit bored, let's say, with all these books to movies that are coming out. And last couple of years, we've had all this young adult fiction that's made its way to the screens. And it's usually, most of them are set in a post-apocalyptic dystopian wasteland where kids have got to fight to the death.
Good news, this one isn't either of those.
That's exactly right. And like another great drama a couple of years ago, The Perks of Being a Wallflower, this is actually set in the now. This is from a novel by a guy called John Green. It's up for release this week. As we said, we chortled about it, but this might have some depth. There may be something more going on in here. And it should have Christian parents asking, how do I help my kids find their significance in a world whose values are often not worth the paper they're written on? That could come from Paper Towns, because we're not the people to talk about this. You caught up this week with book expert and just fantastic radio talent, Cara Martin, to ask her all about Paper Towns.
Cara, thanks very much for being with us on The Big Picture, and particularly to help us understand something as complex as, well, teen fiction comes to the flicks. John Green has made an inordinate amount of money producing some of these novels, and Paper Towns is based on one of his earlier ones. Have you had a chance to read the original work?
I have. Yes. So most people will probably know him from The Fault in Our Stars. And to be honest, I think The Fault in Our Stars is a far better book, a far more sophisticated book. It was written 4 years after Paper Towns. So Paper Towns is one of his early works, and it's got that classic John Green sort of genre. So it's got like really snappy dialogue. It's about teenagers who are just in that movement from adolescence to adulthood, which is, I guess, a bit of a cliche in some ways, but he explores it in more depth than a lot of young adult fiction does, and he does that well. We have a wonderful character, actually, Margot Ruth Spiegelman, who is just this amazing woman, apparently. But she has just discovered that her boyfriend of quite a while has been unfaithful to her. So she ropes in her neighbour, Quentin.
This is the awkward guy.
The very awkward
guy. If you see the film clip of this, now we haven't seen the film yet, so this is one of the great things to get the sort of the inside scoop with you. But yes, you've got that classic pairing in the film clips of an awkward guy and a very sassy girl who's going to somehow bring him out of himself. Is that how it works in the books?
Oh, golly, you've already given away the novel. Oh. But yeah, that's exactly what happens. So she takes him on the ride of his night as she plans out a vendetta against the boyfriend, the girl her boyfriend slept with, her friend who knew about it, who didn't tell her. Like, there's all these vengeful activities. She's actually incredibly creative, a little destructive, but much more creative in the way she actually plans and wreaks her revenge. And then she also allows Quentin to actually get some payback on some of the people who bullied him. And that actually begins to give him some strength and power to emerge from the victim status that he's actually had at school. But the next day she disappears. And then the rest of the novel is actually him following some clues that seem to be deliberately left for him by her to actually try and find her. And there's been this throwaway line that she's given, which makes him think that she is actually so distraught by what's happened that she's going to commit suicide, and she wants him to be the one to find her body. So it's sort of like this.
Oh gosh! So it's not, because it's being presented as almost a treasure hunt, you know, with love at the end. And yet you're saying it could actually be, well, like The Fault in Our Stars, a much sort of darker finish.
If the movie doesn't set up that whole thing of him possibly, you know, expecting to find her, like for him it's a rush against time, not for love, but to actually try and stop her doing this act that he thinks she might do, That's a very different motivation. So it'd be interesting if the movie has twisted that around, which does sound a little bit Hollywoody.
I'm interested as to sort of the philosophy that sort of undergirds this. If he's dealing with an idea of somebody potentially ending their life, what is the reason given for staying alive? What is the reason given for life itself? Is it something you can get behind as a Christian?
Yeah. So when I was encountering the novel, there seemed to be quite a lot of biblical references, which, you know, surprised me a little bit. But I found out since that he was actually, he thought about getting ordained. He's actually really interested in faith. He's an Episcopalian, which is equivalent to our Anglican. He actually pulled out of that. He pulled out of the University of Chicago Divinity School because he saw a brand of Christianity in America which seemed anti-intellectual. And that was something he couldn't go with. And so that sort of explains, you know, there are Christian characters in The Fault in Our Stars, and it sort of explained quite a lot to me about why he goes into that. Unfortunately, he feels like he's mocking Christianity a bit in both books, but in some ways he explains that as being that his characters only mock those things that they actually are invested in emotionally, which is fine, except I'm not sure the readers would get that
subtle
necessarily.
That's yeah. Actually one of those cases where I sort of worry a little bit as an adult, and I guess as a parent, that you've got you're expecting too much of your reader, your viewer there to sort of get the subtleties, in which most kids will just come away with the common denominator. This is funny and I should laugh at it. As a Christian, how do you feel about it?
I think the danger is he basically seems to treat death in both books for the majority of the people as something that's final and that's it. With the emphasis, therefore, on you've got to make the most out of life that you can. And that means that Quentin is actually sort of seduced into some behaviour that he probably wouldn't do normally in paper towns on the basis of, you know, this is it, you get one chance, you know, this is about really living and getting the most out of life. That sort of message, I think, is not very nuanced. He gets much more nuanced in The Fault in Our Stars because there you have, you know, people facing cancer and trying to deal with what might be afterwards. So he gives some different scenarios in that book. I think what I do like is there's a lot of young adult fiction where the parents are really trashed, and in Paper Towns especially, Quentin's parents are both psychologists. They're actually really interested in trying to help Margot as well, and in pointing out some of the shallow parenting that they see in her parents. So there's actually quite a sympathetic view of parents in both those books, and I think that's actually quite nice as a mother to read another mother where, you know, I wouldn't mind being that mother and seeing that there's a nice relationship with the children. I think that I would recommend with all young adult novels that a parent reads the book as well so that you can actually have a dialogue about what you're seeing there and what you're reading and how real it is and the choices, talk about the choices that the characters make, because I think that's a very important thing to do.
Well, Cara, we can only really hope that the film will live up to the book by the sounds of things. And I guess parents, if you don't have a chance to read it first, maybe your kids have, at least go along and see it with them. Paper Towns actually opens this Thursday across the country. Here's a clip to sort of whet your appetite.
The way I figure it, everyone gets a miracle. My miracle was I wound up living across the street from Margot Roth Spiegelman. She was inarguably the most gorgeous creature that God had ever created. Margot's life was a series of unbelievably epic adventures.
Are you going to spend the rest of high school pining for this girl?
As senior year drew to a close, Margot and I were practically strangers. Until this one night.
What the? Margot?
I need to borrow your car.
What?
I have 9 things I need to do tonight.
Can you just get your boyfriend to do it?
Ex-boyfriend.
That's Paper Towns, and of course, Cara Martin, our book reviewer, and we're just... You know, it's fabulous to actually have Cara on the program. Someone who actually went out of her way to make sure she'd read up on all of these novels so that she could actually speak so authoritatively. And I hope
and we didn't have to.
Yeah, it's true. But that said, look, Paper Towns, the movie based on John Green's third book, stars Nat Wolfe and Cara Delevingne, and it's as its two central, awkward, and enigmatic teens. It's rated M for sexual references and releases nationally this Thursday, July 16. Well, that's what the kids are watching, Ben. Now, what will we be watching this week?
Well, I dare say we'll be racing out to see Ant-Man. As much as earlier in the show, we were still trying to make our minds up about how excited we are about it, how we think it's going to go. Ant-Man is going to dominate screens this week, let's be honest, from July 16. But there are a couple of other movies around at cinemas, and a lot of them are actually all linked by... There's an Australian link in all of them. There's a film called Insidious Chapter 3 that, Mark, if you didn't get the first two chapters of Insidious...
Does that mean it's... Another franchise. Okay, there we go.
And it's another horror franchise. And this is written and directed by Lee Whannell, who's the guy who co-wrote Saw. But this one's about a psychic girl who uses her skills to ghost bust some other girl who seems to be haunted by a spook. Yeah, it's like Possession, that kind of movie. If you're into that sort of thing, you probably like it. If you don't, you won't want a bar of it.
Yeah.
That's at cinemas. Also at cinemas is a film called Reuben Guthrie. This is an Australian dark comedy drama, actually stars Patrick Bramall from Glitch, the TV series you talked about earlier in the show. He's the title character, Reuben Guthrie. He's an ad guy whose life washes up on the rocks of alcoholism. And this is written and directed by quite a famous Australian actor, Brendan Cow. And it's also starred Jack Thompson and Alex Dimitriades. But it's meant to be quite a serious look at our culture of binge drinking and excessive drinking.
It shines a light on how hard it is in Australia to actually walk that straight and narrow.
How much encouragement there is to go ahead and keep on drinking even when you're trying to give it up. So Reuben Guthrie is at cinemas. And very quickly, Women He's Undressed is at cinemas. The very provocative title of a documentary about, I'm ashamed to admit this, I had no idea who this guy was. A bloke called George Kelly, who was originally from Kiama in sort of the 1910, 1920s period. He went to Hollywood in the 1920s and became Ori Kelly. And he made about 280 films, and he was like costume designer to the stars. And he did the costume design on Casablanca and Some Like It Hot. Mm. And he earned a whole bunch of Oscars. And really...
A South Coast boy. I come from the South Coast too. Legend.
But one of the amazing things about him is all of that, and he's really highly unknown in Australia. So the documentary is about that, the fact that he just isn't known. But also, it plays up this very provocative relationship that he had with Cary Grant, and it makes all kinds of allegations about the nature of their relationship. It's a very interesting presentation of his life, that time in Hollywood, and the secret lives of Hollywood stars. So Women He's Undressed, provocative documentary that's showing at cinemas. And Mark, very quickly on DVD and Blu-ray, Maggie. Have you heard of Maggie?
No.
No, I'm not surprised you say that.
Was it a graphic novel?
No, I don't think it was. But it does star Arnold Schwarzenegger, who, after his term in office over there in California, is now back on screens. He's around in Terminator Genesis, but that wasn't enough to get Maggie to the big screen, even though it also stars Little Miss Sunshine herself, Abigail Breslin. Maggie is... You talked about Glitch earlier in the show, about the undead or people rising from the dead in country Victoria. Maggie is about some plague going through the Midwest of America and turning people into cannibalistic zombies. But instead of it being like a kind of action horror, that kind of movie, it's meant to be more a dark indie drama, I think, about a father trying to protect his daughter.
Colour me intrigued.
Yeah, that's Maggie, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger. And very quickly, another horror film that's out. And again, word of warning to those out there, there is very graphic scenes in this film. But It Follows is this independent horror film from the States, which has generated more noise, I think, than any other horror film, I'd say, for almost the last 5 to 10 years. And it's got a really fascinating premise about possession and sex and sacrificing your whole body. And this is all in the name of chilling horror. So, again, this may not be your cup of tea, but people are definitely talking about It Follows, and that's out on DVD and Blu-ray.
Well, TV, again, you know, a mixed bag of what's coming up this week. It's much simpler. This week, the ABC actually launches its series, How Not to Behave. You know, which is actually, basically, it's a comedy series.
Thank you.
It's actually kind of really interesting. I've seen some preview stuff of it, and I think it's fun. Gretel Colleen and Matt Okina are set to host this new 15-part comedy series, which basically takes you into a range of social circumstances. On the one hand, you're looking at sketch comedy. But on the other hand, what you're actually looking at is this behavior does not work in our society, and maybe we should be thinking about that. And I actually think it's good viewing. It's fun. Look, you know, because it's on an appropriate time slot, because it has some sort of related nudity in it, you've got to be careful. But that said, look, How Not to Behave, well worth a watch. And that's what's coming out this week,
mate. That's this week. Next week on the show, dude, we're going to be talking about Mr. Holmes.
I am really looking forward to telling you guys about this. Mr. Holmes is a fantastic film. You're going to have to tune in next week.
The old version of Sherlock Holmes. We're also going to be talking about another artificial intelligence movie, Selfless. And also, we're going to man up.
Finally.
That's next week. I'm Ben McKechnie.
I'm Mark Hadley.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production and part of Hope 103.2's family of podcasts and vodcasts.